A smile played at the corners of his mouth. I'm okay, I said to Ranger. And Julie was okay when I left her this morning. Morelli was behind me.
Find anything? He asked Ranger.
Scrog had a back door. The green Dodge that's parked here is the car he took on Stark Street. It looks to me like he went through the woods with Julie. If you follow the trail he left, you come to another dirt road. He probably had a car stashed there. There are fresh tire treads on the road. Tank is walking the road. I'm going to drive out and meet him.
Mary Maisonette and a guy in a dress shirt and suit pants walked toward us. I crooked an eyebrow at Ranger.
Feds, Ranger said.
I looked at Morelli. Did you know?
Yeah, I knew.
And you didn't tell me?
Nope,
Morelli said. I gave him a raised eyebrow that shouted, angry girlfriend.
Keep me in the loop, Ranger said,
and he jogged to his car. What are you doing now? I asked Morelli.
This ties to my homicide. I'm going to stay here and get the crime lab started. I'll get a uniform to take you home, wherever that is.
I'm going to my parents' house. My mother owes me a cake. Chapter 23.
Where were you? Grandma asked me. You look like you've been on an all-night bender.
I was working. I'm going upstairs to take a shower and change my clothes. Here's one of the great things about going home. Whatever clothes happen to be left in my mother's care magically get cleaned and pressed. I don't leave a lot of clothes there, but whatever's in the closet is ready to go. Nothing stays left in a heap on the floor. I stood in the shower until I ran out of hot water. I brushed my teeth 3 times. I fluffed my hair dry and pulled it back into a ponytail. I got dressed in jeans and a t-shirt and went downstairs in search of food. I settled on a chunk of leftover lasagna. I took it to the table and forked into it cold. It seemed like a lot of effort to nuke it. I could see my mother trying hard not to interfere, but I knew she really wanted to heat the stupid lasagna. I dragged myself out of my chair and slid the lasagna into the microwave. My mother looked enormously relieved. Her daughter wasn't a total loser. She heated her lasagna like a civilized person. I took the warm lasagna back to the table and dug in. My mother gave me a padded envelope.
Before I forget, this just came for you. A young man dressed in black delivered it while you were in the shower.
One of them range man hunks, Grandma said.
I looked in the envelope and found the 2 cell phones I left in the parking lot, plus the keys to my Mini. I went to the living room and peered out to the street. The Mini was parked at the curb. I went back to the kitchen and finished the lasagna.
Are you going shopping for a new band outfit today? I asked Grandma.
I gave up on the band, Grandma said. I threw my back out with all that wiggling around. I had to sleep on the heating pad all night. I don't know how those rock and roll people do it. Some of those people are as old as me.
Nobody's as old as you, my father yelled from the living room. You're older than dirt.
Yeah, but I'm pretty good for being so old, Grandma said. I'm thinking I might be better with getting a gig as one of them piano bar singers. I could wear one of them slinky dresses with a slit up the side.
When I was done with the lasagna, I plodded upstairs to my bedroom, flopped onto the bed, and crawled under the covers. I was exhausted. I needed a couple hours of sleep before rejoining the hunt for Julie. Probably there were better equipped people than me out there, but I'd make whatever contribution I could. Grandma hovered over me.
Are you awake? She asked.
I am now.
We're eating. I figured you'd want to know.
I'll be down right away.
I sat on the edge of the bed and called Morelli. Anything?
No. This guy is good at disappearing.
I think part of his success is that he thinks ahead and then he moves fast. He was already on the plane heading north before the word went out in Miami. He was out of the parking garage with me in the trunk of his car before anyone realized the panic button was left behind. And he had a car ready and waiting to make an exit from the motorhome. And I'm betting he knew exactly where he wanted to go.
Most people at this stage would just keep driving. Put as much distance as possible between point A and point B.
He talked about going to Mexico to start a new life, but I don't think he can do that until he gets his fantasy together. I think he has to get rid of Ranger first.
I can identify with that one,
Morelli said. I disconnected Morelli and called Ranger.
Are you okay? I asked him.
I'm managing.
Any luck?
It's like the earth swallowed this guy.
He needs to eliminate you before he can move on.
Many have tried. None have succeeded. Tell me about Julie,
She was a little bedraggled-looking, but she seemed healthy. She's a lot like you, brave and resilient. She said she hadn't been molested. I think women might be something Scrog needs to acquire to play his role, but I don't think he's a sexual deviant. He's constructed this weird world for himself. It's like he moves in and out of a game, and he kills people who get in his way. I think Julie will be safe with him, at least for a while.
Do you have any idea where he might be hiding?
I don't think he'll go far. He gets food and spare change by robbing convenience stores. He goes out early in the morning and brings back a couple bags of candy bars and snack cakes. He might be able to do something with that. And he's going to be stalking you. Aside from that, I just don't know.
What's your plan?
I don't have much of a plan. I'm at my parents' house right now, but I think I'll go back to my apartment tonight. Morelli's in his own house, and you don't need to camp out anymore. That leaves Rex all by himself.
Are you evicting me?
Yes.
We have unfinished business, Ranger said.
We always have unfinished business. Just out of morbid curiosity, how would you define your role in my life?
I'm dessert, he said.
Something that gives me pleasure but isn't especially good for me?
Something that could never be the base of your food pyramid.
See, here's where I was in trouble. Dessert was the base of my food pyramid. I was holding a bag of leftovers from my mom and a bag of clean clothes, plus the shoulder bag I'd left in the mini when I changed cars in the parking lot. I juggled the bags, fumbled with the key, and let myself into my dark, quiet apartment. I maneuvered into the kitchen and dumped everything on the counter. Rex was on his wheel, running, running, running. I tapped on the case and said hello. It was good to be home. Good to be alone. Ranger had just very nicely uncomplicated my life. Don't count on me to be meat and potatoes, babe. Decent of him to be honest. Not that I didn't already know it. Still, it helped to have it articulated. I sighed. Who was I kidding? It didn't help at all. Any more than the attempt to come back to my apartment and normalize my life helped to erase Julie from my thoughts. Julie Martine was a dull ache in my chest. The ache was constant, and all the more painful since I had no clue how to help in her search. At least when I was bait, I had some purpose. I was sidelined now, left with nothing to do but wait. I couldn't imagine what it must be like for her mom. Truly terrible. I pulled a package of sliced turkey out of the leftover bag, some rolls fresh from the bakery, a wedge of chocolate cake, and then sizzle. Again. Shit. I didn't have a lot of furniture. A table and four chairs in the dining room. A couch and a comfy chair in the living room. A television on a low chest. A coffee table in front of the couch. When I came around, I was in the living room, facing in such a way that I could see people entering from the little entrance foyer. I was sitting on a dining room chair, held to it by electrician's tape, my hands painfully cuffed behind the chair. Julie was slumped in the single, comfy chair. Her face was ghost white and slack. Her eyes were drugged slits, barely open, unseeing. Her hands lay loose in her lap. "What did you do to her?" I asked Scrog.
"She's okay. Just knocked out. I had to leave the motorhome in a hurry. I didn't have time to make another bomb. Easier to zap her and give her a shot."
"How did you get in here?"
"I used a pick I bought on the internet."
Scrog looked terrible. He had blood all over him from when I'd punched him in the nose. His eyes were black and swollen. His lip was cut. His foot was still in his shoe, and the shoe was wrapped around and around with the electrician's tape. He was sitting in the living room with me in another of my dining room chairs, pulled to the side, out of view from the front door. He had a gun in his hand. "I feel sick," I whispered, head down. I was dripping drool and snot, and my stomach was in a nauseous freefall. I was scared and horrified, and I'd been stun-gunned one too many times.
"Are you gonna throw up?"
"Yeah." He limped to the bathroom and came back with the wastebasket just in time for me to fill it with my mother's roast chicken and chocolate cake.
"That's disgusting," he said.
"Maybe if you'd stop stun-gunning me." He limped back to the bathroom and I heard him flush the toilet. He limped back and eased himself into his chair. "You look like you could use some of the joy juice you gave Julie," I said to him.
"I took some Advil."
"Are you still going to Mexico?"
"Yeah. Maybe I'll work my way south and go to Guatemala. I think I heard they need bounty hunters there."
If I didn't hate him so much, I might feel sorry for him. Poor, stupid, crazy moron.
Why are you here? I asked him. Why don't you just steal a car and start driving?
I can't. It won't work unless I get rid of him.
He rubbed his temple with his fingertips.
Headache, he said. I think I might have a concussion from when I hit my head on the sidewalk. That was really bad of you. You're such a bitch. I was going to take you with me, but now I think I'll get rid of you, too. I even know how I'll do it. I'll execute you. I'll put the barrel of the gun to your head and bang, a bullet in the brain.
You don't need to get rid of anyone, I said. It'll just slow you down. You should leave now before someone finds you.
I can't. Don't you understand? He's ruining it. I hate him. He's stolen my destiny. He has my identity. Oh, boy.
Why Ranger? I asked.
I was supposed to be him. The minute I saw him, I knew. I was working in this dorky record store, and one day he came in with his partner and arrested some slime bag. It was like a movie. He was all dressed in black like a SWAT guy, and he just walked up to this creep and cuffed him. He was wearing a gun, but he didn't draw. He just cuffed him and marched him out. Man, it was so cool. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized something went wrong. I was supposed to be him. I even looked like him. So I asked the guard at the door who he was, and I started finding out about him, that he was a bounty hunter and all. I figured I had to find a way to get what was mine, you know, like my identity, my destiny. Before that, I was going to be a cop. I was all set. I was working part-time at another mall doing security, waiting for my cop job to start. So it was lucky it all happened when it did, because I might have been a cop, and that would have been all wrong.
Couldn't Edward Scrogg be a bounty hunter?
I guess, but it wouldn't be right. It got mixed up somehow. I just knew I was supposed to take over. I always knew I'd have to kill him. I always knew it was just a matter of time, Scrogg said. I had to get my ducks in a row first.
He squinched his eyes together.
This headache is bad. I can hardly think.
Maybe you should lay down, sleep it off.
I can't. I have to be ready. He's gonna come here. I can feel it. He's living here with you. All his stuff's here. I just have to kill him, and then I can get some sleep.
Scrogg had his head down between his knees.
As soon as I kill him, it'll all get better.
I glanced over at Julie and realized her color was improved. She was still slack-faced and slumped in the chair, but she was watching Scrogg through the slitty eyes. The drug was wearing off, I thought. It had to be maybe 9:30. It was true that Ranger had his computer here, but that wasn't reason enough for him to return. I told him he was evicted. I wasn't sure what would happen as the evening wore on and Ranger didn't show. I worried Scrogg would become more erratic, more desperate. Ranger isn't living here anymore, I said. He was just staying here because the police were looking for him and he couldn't go home. Now that the police aren't looking for him, he'll go back to Range Man.
I don't believe you. His clothes are here. His computer is here. He was staying here, so I couldn't get to you.
His hands were at his head again, and he was rocking with the pain.
I hate him. I hate him. And he isn't Ranger. Stop calling him that. I'm Ranger.
I looked over at Julie, and her eyes tracked to me. Her lids were still lowered, but her eyes were clear and focused. Julie was faking the drug. My hands hurt, I said to Scrogg. You have me all taped up to this chair. Why do I have to be handcuffed, too? If you just take the cuffs off, I'll be good, I swear.
You broke my nose. You're a maniac. Those cuffs aren't coming off until you're cold and dead.
It was an accident, I said. I was...
Shut up, he said, pointing the gun at me. If you don't shut up, I'll kill you now. The only reason you're alive is so you can see him die, but I'll kill you now if it's the only way to shut you up.
We all sat in silence for what seemed like a long time. Julie was slumped in her fake, drug-induced slumber. I squirmed in my seat, hoping to little by little stretch out the tape. Scrogg stayed vigilant in his chair, breathing heavy, cradling his gun in his lap, never letting go of the gun. The only sound in the apartment was the occasional squeak of Rex's wheel. And then we all heard the lock tumble on my front door. Scrogg was out of his chair, moving forward toward the foyer. He flattened himself to the living room wall and took the safety off the gun.
"If you say anything," he whispered to me, "I'll shoot the girl."
His face was flushed, and his eyes were feverish and crazy, and I absolutely believed him. I saw Julie's hand clench and then release. She was fighting to stay slack in the chair. I had my heart in my throat. I thought chances were better that Morelli would walk through the door than Ranger. Someone was going to get shot, and I was powerless to stop it. Chapter 24. The door opened and closed. There was a moment of silence, and then the soft sound of unhurried footsteps. My heart was pounding in my chest, and I didn't know what to wish. Scrogg was going to shoot whoever walked into the living room. He had the gun raised and ready, two-handing it for accuracy. One of the men in my life was about to be eliminated. I was sacrificing him for a little girl. A sob escaped from somewhere deep in my throat, disturbing the silence. Scrogg didn't hear the sob. Scrogg was concentrating on the slight rustle of clothes and scuff of shoes on carpet. And then Ranger appeared in the living room. He was back to a SWAT uniform of black cargo pants and long-sleeved black-collared shirt rolled to the elbow. Our eyes met, and there was no shock of surprise in Ranger's eyes. He had his hands raised. He'd walked in knowing Scrogg was here. He turned his head and looked directly at Scrogg. And Scrogg shot him. I didn't know how many rounds went into Ranger. It was a blur of sound and movement. The force of the gunshot knocked him back. He crumpled to the floor and Scrogg moved over him. Scrogg looked at him for a moment, gun poised.
"Execution time," Scrogg said.
"No!" Julie shrieked, catapulting herself out of the chair. She flew into Scrogg, clawing at him, eyes wild. They went to the carpet with Julie scratching and kicking and screaming. The gun fell out of Scrogg's hand. They both lunged for the gun. There was a shot. Scrogg scrabbled away from Julie. She had the gun. She aimed and fired. A bloodstain flowered on Scrogg's shirt. She was about to shoot again, and the room filled with people. Trenton cops, federal agents, paramedics. Morelli. Morelli had me up and walking around. I couldn't remember getting the cuffs removed or the tape cut away. I clung to Morelli and I couldn't breathe. They brought oxygen to me, but I still couldn't breathe. From the corner of my eye, I could see them working over Ranger, hooking him to an IV, shouting orders, running with equipment, and I just couldn't breathe. I was crying and choking, and there wasn't enough air in the room. Morelli scooped me up and carried me outside to the hall, away from the insanity in the apartment. He was talking to me, but I couldn't hear what he was saying. He moved me flat to the wall, and they came through with Ranger. They had the elevator doors open and waiting. They rolled him past me. His eyes were closed, oxygen mask over his mouth and nose, shirt cut away, blood everywhere. Julie was running beside the stretcher, her hand clenched onto the strap holding Ranger secure. Someone tried to stop her and she slapped him away.
"This is my father," she said. "I'm going with him."
Morelli turned to me with a small, rueful smile.
"The apple didn't fall far from the tree with that one."
I nodded.
"Do you want to follow them to the hospital?"
Morelli asked. I nodded again. Morelli took me down the stairs and through the lobby. Ranger was already on his way out of the lot when we walked through the doors. A black Rangeman SUV followed the EMS truck. Morelli buckled me in and ran around to the driver's side.
"He might be okay," Morelli said. "They'll know more when they get him into X-ray. He was wearing a vest. From what I could see, he took four in the chest. One of them penetrated, maybe not entirely. Even if it hadn't, at that close range, they'd knock him out. He took two more, one in the shoulder and one sliced into his neck. It was a neck wound that produced all the blood. Sonny Raspich was working EMT, and he said he thought it looked worse than it actually was. He said it looked like a clean slice that didn't hit anything vital."
Morelli had his Kojak light on the SUV roof, but he didn't speed to the hospital. He drove sane and steady, and he kept an eye on me. By the time we got to Hamilton, I was breathing almost normally. "I'm okay," I said to Morelli. "I just had a slight overdue panic attack back there."
I've seen you in the middle of a lot of disasters. I've never seen you in that bad shape.
I didn't know who was walking into my living room, but I knew it had to be you or Ranger. Scrog was hiding with his gun in his hand, and he said he'd shoot Julie if I said anything. It was like I had to choose who lived and who died. And I didn't know what to do, and then when Ranger was shot...
Morelli pulled to the side and put his arm around me, because tears were running down my face, dripping off my chin and soaking into my shirt.
It wasn't your fault that Ranger got shot, Morelli said. There were no good choices for you to make. It would all have played out the same. Except you probably saved Julie from getting shot. Ranger went in as a target. He had tanks still doing surveillance on you. When you went back to your apartment, Ranger swept the area and discovered the car Scrog had used. How he picked that car out is a miracle. It was parked two blocks away, looking like any other car in the dark. I think he's psychic sometimes. Scrog left some trace bloodstains on the seat. I would never have found them.
I was stupid. I thought Scrog didn't want to have any more to do with me. I should have thought he'd go to my apartment and wait for Ranger.
Sometimes it's the obvious that we miss. I remember you saying the reason Scrog succeeds is that he thinks ahead and moves fast. And that's exactly what he did. He went directly from the motorhome to the car he had hidden to your apartment.
I had myself back under control, so Morelli put the car in gear and pulled into traffic.
Ranger called me and said he found the car, and he thought Scrog was camped out in your apartment with you and Julie. We pulled a task force together and decided on a plan. Ranger knew Scrog wanted him, so he thought the safest way to go was to give himself up. He went in hoping he could talk to Scrog, and he knew there was a good possibility he'd get shot. He had the vest on. We had the EMT parked around the corner. Maybe Ranger was a mess inside, but he didn't show anything. He was eerily calm. I think if it was me, I might have at least had to make a trip to the bathroom.
Something became very clear to me when I was waiting to see who was going to walk into my apartment, I said to Morelli. He looked over at me. I love you, I told him.
Yeah, Morelli said. I know, but it's nice to hear you say it. I love you, too.
What wasn't said was that I also loved Ranger. But one thing at a time, right? Morelli parked in a small lot reserved for emergency vehicles, and we went into the ER together. The waiting room was filled with guys in black rangeman uniforms.
Blood donors, Morelli said.
And it was horrible, but true. Tank was standing with an arm around Julie. How is he? I asked Tank.
Don't know. We're waiting to hear. They took him right into the OR. He was awake when he came in, so maybe that's a good sign.
Have you called your mom? I asked Julie.
Yes. I just got off the phone with her. She was really happy that I was okay. Her and my dad are going to fly up here to get me. She said she wasn't putting me on a plane alone, and she told Tank he wasn't to let me out of his sight.
Julie grinned.
She's a little overprotective.
I pulled Morelli to a quiet corner. Did she kill Scrog?
He wasn't dead when they hauled him out. I hate to bring this up, but you don't smell great.
I threw up.
That would do it.
Melvin Pickle was in a state. He was sitting rigid on the faux leather couch in the bond office with his hands tightly clenched in his lap. His hair was newly cut and combed. His shoes were polished. His badly fitting clothes were clean and pressed. It was Monday, and he was scheduled for court. He was armed with a verification of employment from Connie and a letter of apology to the theater. I was on hand to drive Melvin to court and make sure he got through the ordeal without jumping off a bridge. I was dressed in my court outfit of black heels, a little black suit, and a white knit tank top. Melvin was first up, and with any luck, we'd all be done by noon. Joyce got the money for capturing Lonnie Johnson, didn't she? I asked Connie.
It just about killed me to have to give it to her, Connie said.
Lula was on the couch next to Pickle.
She should have at least split it with you. You were the one who blew Johnson up. She would have never got him if it wasn't for you.
And we're keeping her on? I asked, already knowing the hideous answer.
Damn right we're keeping her on, Vinny yelled from his office. She brought in two big bonds. Count 'em, two!
Life is so unfair, I said to Connie.
I'm really nervous, Pickle said. I don't want to go to jail.
You won't go to jail, Lula said, and even if you do, it won't be for real long. I mean, how much time can a little chicken shit pervert like you get? And then when you get out, we're going to go look for an apartment for you so you don't have to live with your mother. Now that you got a job here, you can move out.
We have to go, I said to Pickle. We don't want to be late.
Connie handed me two folders. New FTAs, she said. Nothing exciting. A wife beater in Grand Theft Auto. I shoved the files into my shoulder bag. Maybe I'd look at them tomorrow. Maybe never. Maybe I needed a new job. Problem was, I'd gone that route recently and it hadn't turned out great. But maybe I just lacked direction. Maybe if I had a plan this time, like opening a business. That could be exciting, right?
You got that look, Lula said to me, like you're going to start driving and not stop until you get to Hawaii.
I eased the Mini to the curb in front of the bond's office, and I was smiling along with Pickle.
10 days of community service, Pickle said for the 100th time, and I can do it on weekends, and probably it'll be fun. Maybe I can work at an old people's home or an animal shelter. I can't wait to tell Lula and Connie.
I was genuinely happy for Melvin Pickle. It turns out he's a nice guy. And I mean, who doesn't occasionally whack off in the multiplex? I've never tried it personally, but who am I to judge? I dropped Pickle at the door and I drove 2 blocks to Giovicini's market and got some cut flowers. It was almost noon. Ranger was scheduled to leave the hospital this morning, so he should be home by now back in his apartment at Rangeman. Morelli had taken Scrog's computer and scrapbook as evidence. I had Ranger's computer and various office machines in my trunk and back seat. I let myself into the underground Rangeman garage and parked in one of Ranger's private spaces. I left the office equipment in the car, took the flowers in a bakery box, and stepped into the elevator. I waved at the security camera and used my passkey to get to Ranger's private floor. I keyed his apartment door open and stuck my head in and called to him.
In my office, he said.
He was at his desk, dressed in gray sweatpants and a sleeveless gray sweatshirt. A large square bandage was taped to his neck, and his right shoulder was wrapped in heavy gauze and held tight to his body in a canvas sling. I could see his chest was wrapped in tape where the bullet had penetrated the Kevlar vest and splintered a rib.
I'd get up, he said, but the rib is the killer when I move.
No need to get up, I told him. I moved some papers out of the way, sat my ass on his desk so that I was facing him, and gave him the flowers in the gift box. I brought get well presents. He looked into the box.
Birthday cake?
I thought your food pyramid might need some cheering up.
It says Happy Birthday, Stanley.
It also isn't your birthday, but I don't see why that should stop us from eating cake. Have you had lunch?
No. Ella brought a tray, but I wasn't hungry.
Are you hungry now? He looked down at my bare legs and little skirt.
I'm getting there.
I slid off his desk and went to the kitchen. I prowled around and found some sandwiches and brought them in on the tray along with some forks. I set the tray on his desk and pulled a chair over for myself. Things are going to be pretty dull around here with only one ranger, I said. Ranger forked an icing rose off the cake and fed it to me.
One ranger is all you'll ever need.
Hi, this is Lorelei King, and I was lucky enough recently to have the chance for a little girl talk with Janet Ivanovich when we were both in New York City. And here's what we said.
Janet, it's so great to be face-to-face with you here in New York City, and it's so exciting. I'm here, of course, recording 12 Sharp, but what are you doing in New York?
I'm here for the Mystery Writers Award Banquet. It's Mystery Writers of America once a year holds the Edgar's Awards. It's like the Oscars. It's a very prestigious, very wonderful award for, and there are a lot of categories, for best mystery in television, in movies, best mystery novel, best YA mystery. And I'm president this year.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm Madam President. I'm very honored. They asked me to be president, and they said to me it was pretty much a figurehead position. But you know me, I can't. I have my fingers everywhere, and I've been loving it. I'm very flattered that they wanted me to do this. I was nominated for an Edgar way back with One for the Money. I didn't win. Always a bridesmaid.
Never a bride.
Yeah. But here I am now, the president, and I get to go to the banquet.
Fantastic.
I get all dressed up.
What are you wearing?
I am very good. I am wearing Armani, which is a stretch for me because Jersey Janet is much more gold lamé, you know, with the big clunky shoes and the hem 3 inches below my ass. But I'm doing the right thing by Mystery Writers. I'm going to be very classy. I went to Armani that got me a long floor-length skirt.
Mm.
Yeah, probably an hour and a half into the program, I'll be wearing my Armani with sneakers. I'll be going barefoot. But, yeah, it's a black tie. It's very fancy. My husband is here with me in his tux. Don't you love a man in a tux?
Oh,
what is it about
gorgeous.
A tux? I think a tux is very sexy.
Oh, we've not seen Ranger in a tux.
Wouldn't that be?
That would be fabulous.
Oh, man.
Is it hot in here?
13, yes.
13.
Oh, phew. Oh, that, I love that idea.
I know, it'd be brilliant.
Ranger in a tux. We'd have to undress him.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the best part about a tux.
Yes.
Yeah. So, Madam President, how long will you be holding office?
1 year. It's a year position. It goes January to January.
It is an incredible honor. Who, for example, was the president last year?
Margaret Maron is the outgoing president. And a lot of friends of mine, you know, have died. Sue Grafton was president for a year. Michael Connelly. So we give each other a chance to do this. So when they came to me and they asked me to do this, I was just incredibly flattered.
And what will your duties be at the ceremony itself?
I don't think I have a whole lot of duties. I'm supposed to, you know, show up and try not to get, you know, drink too much wine and embarrass myself. And I introduce someone. I get to go on stage and introduce someone.
Excellent. Yes. I hope it's someone early on so you can enjoy the...
So I can have the wine.
Enjoy
yeah.
the wine at the table. We just finished recording 12 Sharp, which is fantastic. And I got very excited because early on, we know we're going to learn a lot more about Ranger. And there's quite a shocker, in fact, early on about him.
Yes, Mrs. Ranger shows up.
Mrs. Ranger. I had a sharp intake of breath when I came to that. And we learn a lot more about his background and where he grew up. Have you grown fonder of Ranger as a character over the years?
Yeah, Ranger's gotten taller over the years as he's gotten a little bit better looking and a little bit more successful and a little bit better educated. What happened with Ranger was in the initial book, in One for the Money, I needed someone to mentor Stephanie, and I modeled Ranger after some actual bounty hunters that I had been hanging out with. As the series progressed, by about book three, I realized that I was going to need something to complicate her love life because she and Joe Morelli were getting very close, and I didn't want to turn this into a romance. I didn't want them to get married and live happily ever after. I thought that was kind of boring. So so I brought Ranger in. He was already sitting there, you know, and I just kind of cleaned him up a little bit. And every book, Ranger gets to be a little bit more of the man of mystery. He's always the man of mystery. But I like to feed the reader and myself, you know, too, a little bit more about Ranger all the time. We get a lot of letters asking about Ranger, and they ask things like, you know, does Ranger have chest hair, and when is Ranger's birthday? And, you know, my answer to is, you know, he has chest hair if you want him to. He's fiction, and he can be whoever you want. And that's kind of his allure, is that we don't, even this book where I divulge a little bit more of Ranger, there still are lots and lots of pieces that we don't see to Ranger. So, you know, he's a fantasy guy.
He's definitely a fantasy guy. And almost as shocking as Mrs. Ranger was the fact that he was wearing sweatpants for me.
they were very sexy sweatpants.
I bet he looked good in the sleeveless sweatshirt.
Yeah, they fit his butt just right, you know, and the sleeveless, so, you know, you could see a little Ranger chest.
But it was fun. It gave him a lot of depth, and you just said something about wanting Stephanie to have this romantic conflict with Morelli, who I love as well. I'm a babe cake, I guess you'd say. Stephanie has a real emotional journey in this novel, and she finally says, I love you, to Morelli.
She says the L word.
Yeah.
She's been struggling with that for how many years now? You know, poor guy. And she has a commitment issue. But there's some really bad things that happen in this book. Of course, they end up well because this is a happy book, but, you know, but Stephanie realizes some things and she does. She finally says the L word to Morelli.
And yet she doesn't, her affection for Ranger doesn't seem to have diminished at all. And I think it's really interesting. Would she feel the same about Morelli if Ranger didn't exist? It's almost like they're two facets of the same man, or she needs something that each of them has.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? I had never actually thought about it that way, but I think you're absolutely right. I think they each give Stephanie something that she needs. And it's a real dilemma. It's a dilemma for Stephanie. And this is one of the things that drives the series now, is this dilemma Stephanie has where she is actually in love with these two men.
I know your fans must drive you mad asking which one she's going to end up with.
Yeah, I get that all the time. And I think if we ever decide to end the series, I'll probably have to do two books. So, you know, she ends up with each guy.
I think that's an excellent idea. Then you could take your pick. And in this book, she seems more resigned to her position. She's committed to Morelli Earth by saying the L word. And yet she seems to accept now that she just loves both of them.
Yeah. Some of what's happening in the series is that it's a growth process for Stephanie. And things that she hadn't thought about, things that she hadn't wanted to admit to herself, little by little, she's coming to see that she can live with this. She can articulate these things to herself. And Stephanie is a very ordinary person. You know, Stephanie, we all know who Stephanie is. And we all have some of these same problems, you know, maybe not to the degree that Stephanie has, but we all have these ambiguous feelings. We all have crises in our lives. We all have lives that aren't entirely fulfilled by whatever it is that's around us, and we have to learn how to make the best of it. And I think that's one of the appeals to this series, is that if Stephanie can work through this and she can get through her day, maybe we all can.
I think you're right in that Stephanie has matured emotionally and changed and grown. But I'm not sure she's actually gotten any older, has she?
In the beginning, she was 30. In the first book, she was 30. And I just decided that Stephanie and I weren't going to age. I get younger. I've actually reached the point where I'm younger than my daughter.
Excellent.
Yeah. And so I didn't see any reason why Stephanie should age either. It's a fun age. I think that Stephanie is at an age that, again, we all relate to this age. When I go around the country and I talk to people, when I get emails in, what I find is that we have a very diverse audience, and we have a lot of kids who read it, 13-year-old girls and boys, and they all relate to Stephanie at her age. And we have senior citizens who relate to Stephanie at her age. So I think this must be like a universal spot that we all know, you know, what this is. I intend to keep Stephanie there.
I think it's a good idea. It's also an age, if memory serves, where hormones are like rampant for a woman in the 30s.
Yeah.
And so I think that's why she's in such a pickle with these two guys.
Well, they're just so hot. You know, how could she?
Who could resist?
I know. And that's the fun of it. I love that. I love the chase. I like the
yes.
romantic chase. And originally, I modeled the series after Moonlighting. I loved that first series of Moonlighting when Maddie and Dave were in this love-hate relationship, and they were sexy people, but they weren't involved with each other. And then, you know, as that series went on, eventually they did the deed, and it was all over for me. I was like, well, now what? And I decided that I wanted to try to keep that kind of tension in my series, that even though they did the deed, you know, they still kind of pulled back a little bit, and there still was that sense of the chase.
Yes, I agree. I think in life, that kind of thing is exhausting, but in fiction, it's thrilling.
Yeah, well, you know, it's exhausting because of the maintenance.
Mm.
You know, you have to watch your weight, and you can't get cellulite in your thighs, and you have to shave. Acres and acres of skin has to be, you know, pristine. Who could keep up with that? It's just not.
Well, and Stephanie, again, you've touched on watching her weight. She doesn't really seem to watch it. We've often said this girl, any quality of Stephanie's anyone would like to have is her ability to eat cake and stay slim.
That's going to catch up with her. I mean, you know, good thing she just stays 30, because once she hits 34, you know it's going to be downhill. I mean, she has good Hungarian genes. Her metabolism is working for her now. But once in a while, you know, she has to open the snap on her jeans. It's not pretty.
Mm-mm.
But for the most part, she can get away with a lot of stuff that I can't.
There are some great new characters in this book. I've kind of fallen in love with Melvin Pickle because I think particularly love some of these little nebbishy guys you write, like Albert Clown. I'm particularly fond of him. And Melvin Pickle, he seems quite settled in there. Do you think he might be a new regular?
I think he's going to continue. And don't you love that name? Melvin Pickle.
Your names are fantastic. And how do you come up with these interesting names?
You know what? I'll steal from anybody. And my son actually came up with that name. I forget what I had him named, but it was something boring. And my son, my family, you know, we're a little family business. And my son and my daughter and my husband all read the books. And they're my first editors. And I had this boring name for him. And my son said, you know, he needs to have a better name and he needs to be something like Melvin Pickle. So I jumped on that. Melvin Pickle. I mean, you just know who Melvin Pickle is.
With yes, just seeing it and a character is presented.
Yes, and he's a pervert even. He was caught shaking hands with the devil in the multiplex.
When you wrote your first Stephanie Plum mystery, One for the Money, did you imagine there would be this many books?
No, and I find it surprising that there are this many books. I mean, if somebody said to me, how long have you been doing this? I'd probably say a couple of years. And then I think about it and, you know, this is book 12 coming out. It seems like a lot. It's, especially since Stephanie and I aren't getting any older. You know, if I was writing about Stephanie and she was 45 now, maybe I'd have a better sense of how long the series has been going on. But we're kind of stuck here. And at the time went fast. It's been fun.
It has been fun. It's been fun, great fun for me, and it has gone really quickly. Who were your influences as a writer? For example, who were the writers you loved as a child?
I read comic books when I was a kid. I didn't have a lot of exposure to books. This was, you know, 100 years ago, and my parents would take me to the library, and I was able to take one book out every week. And I would get a book for my birthday and a book for Christmas. But for the most part, I read comic books, and I read Donald Duck and Uncle Scrooge. And they were adventure stories, and they were going off to the Yukon looking for gold and sailing down the Amazon. And I think this really is what I'm doing now. I think Donald Duck and Uncle Scrooge gave me this love for the adventure story. And really, you know, it's Indiana Jones. It's Uncle Scrooge. This is what the Plum series is, set in this exotic location of New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And I read the Walter Farley books, the Black Stallion books. So I spent a lot of years as a horse, galloping around, making whinnying sounds, digging holes in people's lawns.
Like Valerie's daughter.
Like Valerie's daughter, yeah.
Mm. It's interesting about the comic books. It just occurred to me, because I find your books incredibly visual. The pictures that come are very, very strong. So I find it interesting that comic books influenced you, which are very visual.
Yeah, and I also started out as an artist. I was always the kid that could draw. And when I went to college, I majored in studio art. I was a painter. It wasn't until I was a stay-at-home mom that I started actually writing books. So my orientation is very visual. I always actually wanted to make movies, but had no entrance into that, had no idea how to even approach that. But I see my books as a movie. When I'm writing, people are walking across the stage, and I learned how to write dialogue by speaking on stage, by doing improv acting.
Speaking of movies, I know a lot of people are wondering, One for the Money, the movie, what's happening? Are there any updates, any more news on it?
Oh, man, One for the Money, the movie. You know, we're all going to be on oxygen by the time they're going to be pushing me to the premiere, you know, in a walker. Columbia TriStar owns it. They bought it before the first book even came out. They, Wendy Finerman is attached to it as a producer. She's working very hard on it. They, for some reason, they just have never been able to find the right equation. They have, I don't know how many scripts. They've had all kinds of people attached. It just never seems to get made. At one point, we even thought about trying to buy it back because I know my fans would just love to see this. And, they were not amenable to it. They were still interested in it, but, you know, the beat goes on. I don't know. I don't know when this is going to get done.
You're right about the fans wanting to see it. I think whoever makes the movie, it might be a little bit of a poison chalice, though, because everyone has, as we said, such a clear idea of who should play what and who looks like what. There would be blood on the floor, I'm sure, over some of the casting.
Yeah, and that's a problem. You know, if they had done the movie right away, they would have had a lot easier time of it. But now, I mean, they better cast right, or my people are going to be up in arms over it.
They'll take to the streets, I know.
Yeah, and you know what's fun is that at signings, I get guys coming now, you know, who look like Morelli.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I did a signing in New York yesterday, and this really hot guy came in. Looked just like Morelli. He really did, you know, with the black hair, and he took his jacket off, let me see his muscles. It was good. It was all good.
Where's your next signing?
Yeah, well, are you
doing another one in New York?
Yes, getting hot in here again. Are we taking clothes off as we speak?
Now, Stephanie Plum is a cultural icon. She has a tremendous fan base, and she has so many fans. I just wonder if you reached the stage yet where you've been contacted by any students doing essays or dissertations on Stephanie.
Yeah, I hear from a lot of students, and some of them are quite serious. Some of them are doing, you know, some of their kids, junior high, high school, doing book reports. Some of them are, I hear from college students who are doing essays on women's roles and, you know, just all kinds of things. It's sort of interesting to see, you know, what happens when you have this ongoing project and how it kind of filters out into all aspects of society.
I think you're right. And I think that's when a character is really enmeshed in a culture is when PhD students start doing it. And I know it's just a matter of time before someone does a PhD dissertation on these characters.
Yeah, I think there actually have already been a few.
Mm.
You know, what really is surprising, though, is if you look at television and you see all of a sudden all of the bounty hunter shows, which I suspect I had something to do with. Mm. While my show never got made, people picked up the idea, and there are just a lot of bounty hunters out there in entertainment land.
You've been writing for a long time now, as we said, not just this series, but others. Has writing gotten easier for you over the years?
In some ways, writing has gotten easier. I think I'm a little bit better at plot. You know, I started as a romance writer, and when you do that, the romance is the plot. And so I never had a chance to really practice a mystery plot. And when I started the Plum series, it was that was always the most difficult part for me, and still is. Truth is, it's the part I'm least interested in. I love the characters. This is a very character-driven series. But I think that I've gotten a little bit better at it. I think number 12 probably has the best plot that I've done so far. It's more suspenseful. It's a little tighter. It's an interesting plot. So in that way, it's gotten easier.
And over the years, have you found that your methods or your routines of writing have changed at all?
I'm not sure that my method and routine has changed. This past year has been very, very hard. I took on a lot of projects and probably have never worked as hard as I have in the past year. I mean, I'm up at 5. I'm at my computer at 5:30 in the morning. I work straight through until noon, 1 o'clock, and then I break and have something for lunch and get some exercise, usually 45 minutes on the elliptical. And then I'm back at work and I work until 5:30, 6 o'clock. And I break and go out and have dinner with my husband and do a little socializing. And then at night, you know, I'm having meetings with my daughter, who is my webmaster, Ivanovich.com. We get about 9 million hits a month on that site now, and it generates a lot of work, a lot of questions to be answered, a lot of planning. So I put in really long days. I work 7 days a week, and it's been like that for this past year. I think I've got maybe 6 more months of that kind of schedule, and it'll back off a little bit for me. I'll start to have a little bit more of a life. I'm looking forward to that. I like what I do. You know, fortunately, I love getting up in the morning and going into the world. I'm always, you know, into the world of Plum or into the world of Alexander Barnaby, me and the cat and a cup of coffee.
You mentioned the website that your daughter Alex runs, which is wonderful. And there are a lot of contests and areas for people to explore. And one of the most popular contests, I think, is the Name the Book contest.
Yes, we started the Name the Book contest because I'm really bad at naming the book. And we went through the first 3 books and we were stuck with this number thing. We never intended to do the number thing. It just sort of happened. And then we didn't know where to go from there. So we decided to hold a contest because, as it turns out, my fans are a lot smarter than I am. And they send all these great titles in. And some of the titles are just, they're amazing. And of course, my publisher never picks those titles because we essentially pick a title that looks good on the book cover. And it means nothing. It means absolutely nothing except it has the appropriate number in it.
And what kind of a prize do they get?
They get their name in the book. and they are then published people in every single book out there. It says, thanks to James Smith for suggesting the title for this book. And they also get, you know, an early copy that's signed, of course. But, yeah, they get their name in the book.
It's a great prize. Did they ever get to appear as a character, I wonder?
No, that's a different prize. That's sometimes I do that for charity purposes. I like to help out Trenton Crime Stoppers. And so for the last couple of years, I've donated a character in the book. And they hold a raffle. And they get lots and lots of money. And then they can give it away in small amounts as little rewards for, you know, information on local crime. So that's what I've been doing with. And that's actually a very hard thing to do, to write someone into a book. You would think it would be an easy job, but you know, you don't want to make them an evil person. They can't be a bad guy. So you have to put, you know, some halfway attractive person in there. And then usually they disappear after that book.
I know a book I'd like to see. I don't know if it's possible, Janet, but I would love to see a Plum cookbook. Reading your book, sometimes it's like, oh, I want that. I want that. Mrs. Plum, Stephanie's mother, making her meatloaf and her pineapple upside down cake and the famous peanut butter and olive sandwich, of course.
Yeah, I've thought of that. I think that would be a lot of fun. And from time to time, we publish some of those recipes. I think on the website, I'm not sure if it's still up there, but there used to be a place where Alex would put the pineapple upside down cake recipe from time to time. And the pot roast recipe, that's easy. Put it in a pot, burn it.
Do you know how many languages your novels are published in?
I don't have a number, but it's just about everything. They really are out there everywhere. They're in China, they're in Russia, they're in Thailand, they're in every little teeny tiny country you could imagine. And I love that. I think it's fun that, you know, I'm worldwide. Although I find that when I travel, even though I'm in a country where my novels are published in that language frequently, they're read in English anyway. So
it makes sense. Most widely spoken second language in the world. It makes sense.
Yeah. Only us Americans sit here with, you know.
Monolingually.
Yeah. Monolingually.
I really love interpreting your characters. And what's great about your writing is you give so many clues that help me in the name, Melvin Pickle, a name suggests itself. Or there's another character who runs Pleasure Treasures who has this, who's 72 and has this real cigarette voice. When you hear a narrator do the book, do you ever shriek and think, no, that isn't what I had in mind at all?
Yeah, but never with you. And that's why I use you with all of my books now, because you get it right on. I've had some in the past. I mean, everybody has their own interpretation. What I've noticed is that sometimes it isn't necessarily that the characters won't sound like the way they are in my head, because I try not to go there. I try to let myself be free to hear whoever it is that, you know, my reader is making them be. But people tend to mispronounce words as Jersey, Janet, you know, we say like Macadam. I had a reader once that called it Macadam.
Oh.
Yeah, drove me insane.
But that's just wrong. That's not Jersey. That's just wrong, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, Macadam. Yeah, it's
named after a person. Isn't it?
Is that
yes?
There's
yes,
someone named Macadam.
There is
Mr. Macadam.
Mr. Macadam, which is it's a Scottish person invented it.
I see. It's always an education when I'm with you, Lorelai.
I said that with great authority. I'm going to go look it up. I'm pretty sure that's right.
Like the Earl of Sandwich
invented the sandwich.
You Brits, you got it all.
Indeed. Have you never thought of recording the books yourself? Were you ever tempted? Because you have stage experience.
Yeah, my stage experience isn't that good. I was never tempted. I don't think that I'm really, that it's not my thing. They would all sound alike. You know, when they make me do a television commercial and they make me read my line 175 times, it's all the same. They keep saying to me, okay, we're going to punch it up this time a little bit more. It's exactly the same. In my mind, I'm shouting it. I'm really giving it everything. But you know, it's not my thing.
You have really touched on something there as a voice artist. I think people don't realize how much you feel like you're screaming in your head or you're doing such an exaggerated accent. And yet when it's played back, it's the most subtle of differences. I don't know why that is. It sounds so big in our heads.
Yeah, I don't know either, but I know that I have absolutely no talent for that, because even when I hear it, even when people tell me, I can't make it any different. And I think it has to do with the kind of confidence that you have, that you as a performing artist, you have the confidence in yourself that you can push yourself beyond a certain point. And since I sit in a room all day long in sweats covered with dog hair all by myself writing books, you know, I don't have that kind of confidence, so I can just never get there.
Well, I, for one, am very happy you don't want to record them yourself, because I just love them, and I feel so close to these characters now. I'm really excited about new technology. And on my iPod, there's now a section for audiobooks, so I've started downloading. And I wondered if you were going to start downloading books to listen to.
I haven't done that yet, but I am in love with my iPod.
So not on the iPod yet, but when you do listen, what kind of audiobooks do you like to listen to, and in what circumstances?
In the car. I listen to audio when I'm in the car. And I like mysteries. I love Robert B. Parker. I think it translates really well. I have this, like, limited brain, you know. I mean, it's always filled up with my own books, so if I'm taking any new information in, I have to dump something. So I like to listen to books that are easy to follow. If it's I try never to have any content in my life. Yeah, I'm very shallow, but it works for me. So that's, you know, that's okay. I like books that are fun. I like simple mysteries. I like Robert B. Parker because his books are always linear. He doesn't have a lot of flashbacks. He doesn't have a lot of complicated stuff. He's such an incredible wordsmith that I find, you know, I'm not going to crash my car trying to listen to the audio while I'm driving. And I would imagine that my books work the same way, because my books have a lot of those same characteristics, with the exception of humor. I have had several people get in touch with me and say they had to pull over because you made them laugh.
And in this book, there is just such a moment when Grandma bends, can I say this? She bends over and she farts in her leather hot pants. It took us 20 minutes to get through this scene. Oh, she said something. She said, "Who stepped on a duck?" And I've never heard this expression.
Yeah, I think I've actually used it once before in one of the other books. It sort of slips in.
Did you make it up?
And, no, actually, I stole it off of television. But it was so perfect. How could you not? I'm willing to steal from anybody. And it was just so perfect. How could you not use that? You would have to, like, write a whole book around it just so you could use that.
It was perfect. Yeah, and I was going to say, in terms of driving in the car, that would be the danger with your books, I think, is the laugh-out-loud moments. And that's what I've always loved about this series, is that, I mean, there's some real drama. And in this one, there's some quite dark stuff as well. You're not afraid to go there with a kidnapped child in 12 Sharp, but it's always lightened and leavened with this wonderful humor that everyone seems to identify with. And so much of it is about families and character-driven humor.
Yes, and, you know, it goes the other way also, because the humor is really the easy part for me. And it would be very easy for me to write 300 pages of humor. But humor can get tedious. You just can't do that. And I see a lot of writers coming along who have this consistently funny book. I think that you just can't do that. You have to periodically raise the stakes for the reader. You have to have a variety of experiences within a book. So I try to have some humor. I try to have some scary moments. I try to have some sexy moments. And then in between there's a lot of pizza.
Janet, thank you so much for taking the time to come in. And we'll leave you now to get ready for your award ceremony, which is very exciting. And it's been a real thrill. And thank you for talking to us.
Oh, it's been great. I love doing this.
We hope you've enjoyed 12 Sharp, an audio renaissance audiobook from St. Martin's Press. This program was produced and directed by Laura Wilson. Post-production by John Marshall Sound. Text copyright 2006 by Ivanovich Inc. Production copyright 2006 by Audio Renaissance, a division of Holtspring Publishers, LLC. All rights reserved.